Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Chris Verga, the author of a book that has just come out called The Nazis of Long Island. And it's a topic that needs to be told because of its astonishing revelations that most people just didn't have any idea were going on here. Chris, where did you begin to think that you should be writing this book?
So a little bit about me. I teach politics of terrorism at John Jay College. So I specialize in radicalization. It's one of the classes I teach over there. And one of the other books I wrote was A Ferguson Brothers Lynching, which actually talked about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan on Long Island and also the pushback against the Klan for the civil rights movement that we have that's kind of overlooked. And while doing this research, I found more and more information about the German-American Bund, which happened to be in Yaphank. And, from there, it's like pulling a string on a sweater, and then there's no more sweater.
How long did you work on this project?
Well, when I was writing Ferguson Brothers Lynching, which essentially was a murder of a World War II soldier in Freeport, there was a lot of overlapping contrast here. So I'm going to be like probably about a year and a half of research, not counting the research I obtained from Ferguson Brothers Lynching book, which was another History Press book as well. So about a year and a half, 2 years, let's say.
What got you interested in this whole topic of people being carried away into strange behavior?
Yes. Well, what got me into it? Well, I'm into civil rights. Long Island is really, really interesting. I remember when I was buying my first house with my wife in 2013, and she's African American. We were kind of being pushed to certain areas to go look at. And, 2013, this is still coming from the Great Recession. You thought for sure people would be hungry, especially when you have 20% to put down. But, they kept kind of steering us to other areas. And I just kind of examined this more and more. And then I found recurring themes of such as the replacement theory, which is not something new, but something that dates back in Long Island to the 20s and 30s and other places as well. Thinking that you're going to be replaced by a minority of today, which is going to become the majority of tomorrow. And that's kind of how I got into the study of this extremism and civil rights in general. When we talk about the German-American boon, that takes a different direction, but there's a lot of parallels as well.
Tell us about some of the more interesting features of Nazis on Long Island and where they were and what they did.
So the German-American Bund originally was Yorkville, Manhattan. It was started. And when it started there, it kind of branched out to every German community. Not all Germans were part of the German-American Bund. I want to make that clear. Not all were part. There was a lot of Germans that denounced the German-American Bund. The German-American Bund, once again, for people that are listening, is the Nazi party, essentially. They're Nazis. Of course, they're called something different here. But what was really interesting was it branched off from Friends of New Germany, which was funded by Hitler's regime in Germany, essentially, to branch off, create more support for the Nazi cause. The German-American Bund came after the Friends of New Germany, which was funded by the Nazi Party. Friends of the German-American Bund was indirectly funded through Hitler, not directly, such as the Friends of New Germany. But what made this so interesting was in all these communities that they did expand in, such as Yaphank, it was worked as a recruitment for spies. So the German-American Bund in Yaphank, when they're having these rallies in Camp Siegfried, you're going to have people that are part of Sperry's Aviation, people that are part of Republic Aviation, building some of the most iconic things for World War II and the Cold War later. And essentially, they're going to trade in their loyalty for America and give it to Germany by becoming spies in those industries. And while this is all going on, to make things even crazier, the German-American Bund is going to build alliances with other far-right groups, and also racist groups such as the KKK, Christian Front. So they're going to move with this alliance of crazy groups, not just the Bund, and they're going to have this thing called Der Tag, the day, when all these groups together are going to rise up, overthrow the United States, and we're going to pave the way for a pro-Hitler government in the United States. And the KKK, Christian Front, and all these other groups, such as the 76ers, not the basketball team, of course, are going to work together with the Bund to make this a pro-fascist, pro-Hitlerite country. And
And
it's right here in our backyard.
talk about where it was and what it was like there. You had this annual, I don't know if it was annual, but you had this camp,
Yeah.
Siegfried. It was sort of the centerpiece of what they did. Why don't you describe it? Tell us where it was and what became of it.
Sure. That's a crazy story in itself. Camp Siegfried is going to be the German-American Bund camp to Nazify your kids. That's pretty much what it is. It's going to feed them through a steady stream of propaganda. They're going to listen to Hitler speeches all day, listen to the music, and the kids are going to grow up to be idyllic little Nazis.
Where is this?
Oh, this was in Yaphank. Sorry about that. This is in Yaphank in the mid to going into late 30s. And it's going to be run by the German-American Bund and Fritz Kuhn. Now, the interesting thing about Camp Siegfried and the Bund in general, they're going to have a bunch of companies and a bunch of camps like this. And they are going to have them under different LLCs, different limited liability companies. So if one gets too much attention, they just close it and create another, like a multiple heads, think of, you know? And these like shell companies. And the German-American settlement is going to be held with Camp Siegfried. And the Bund, it's going to be part of the Bund as well. It's an affiliated group. It's going to operate to as a summer camp to about 1939, when Fritz Kuhn is going to get arrested, essentially. He's the leader of the Bund. It's going to operate in some small form till about 1941, and then it's going to become a permanent settlement for German Americans, and it's going to be called the German American Settlement. And you're going to have to be or prove that you are German ancestry to live there all the way up to 2014 when they took the covenants out through a civil rights lawsuit.
Is this in the area near the what today is the Brookhaven National Lab?
Yes. It's where the stone's throw from Brookhaven National Labs. Yes, that is true, which is really crazy because that's one of the biggest military bases, Camp Upton, and also Brookhaven Labs, and it's right there.
Describe it.
Brookhaven Labs or German American Bund?
Siegfried, Camp Siegfried.
Yeah,
What
so.
if I'm off the bus, what would you see?
Oh boy. So when you got off the bus, you're going into a compound. Everything's German. You got a little kiosk for, Nazi propaganda. You get your little Nazi flags. You get your latest version of Christian Front newspaper, which is called Social Justice. Their definition of social justice, not the normal person's definition. And from there, you're going to be hearing Hitler speeches blaring through the speakers. You're going to hear Wagner, and you're going to see parade grounds of paramilitary Germans with their little leather straps, their guns, their Mausers, etc., etc., or wannabe Mauser guns. And they're going to be practicing. And then when you go further back, you're going to have the tents for the kids. And it's kind of like a German, big German barbecue for parents on the left side of the camp. But where the kids are located, it's going to be a little interesting because this is where it gets a little, well, it's all crazy, I guess, from here, right? So everything sounds normal, whatever we're going with. So what's going to happen in the kids' camp? You got the pre-adolescent teens, age 13 on an average. The camp director said the kids should not be supervised. They should explore themselves. And this is going to lead to a lot of teenage pregnancies. Now, according to the Dickstein House of Un-American Activities, this was kind of by design because these were pure Aryans breeding with pure Aryans. In addition to that, they're going to have all the Nazi indoctrination provided to them, and they're going to advertise different German-American Boone groups, such as the German Boone tourism industry, which goes back to quote-unquote the fatherland to learn about Nazism directly. You're also going to have the German labor front, which is going to be direct recruitment to go back to Germany and work for the Nazi regime. On German Day, it's a little unclear, they had German Day quite often, it was to actually raise money for Nazi bonds for the Nazi war machine. I think one summer, I might be a little off because the German boom did exaggerate their successes. I think they raised one summer over $200,000 for Nazi causes, for Nazi conquest of Europe from Siegfried alone. Once again, this is a stat provided by the German-American Bund.
They had parades.
Yes, they used to have a lot of parades. They used to go march with the little SWAT stickers and little Chanel straps in their little Nazi uniforms up and down Yaphank and make their presence known. They had parades not just in Yaphank, but they also had parades even in New York City. Of course, one of the most famous rallies is George Washington's birthday in the Madison Square Garden, where they're going to have tens of thousands of people come out to say how Nazism is compatible with, you know, American republicanism. And they're also going to say that Washington was the first Nazi. So if you ever look at that, I think PBS did a documentary on this, you know, you're going to see Washington at one side of the podium and, you know, giant picture of Washington with the Boone SWAT sticker flag on the left side. And they're going to try to weave the two together, essentially.
What were some of the, I think they paraded down Main Street in Bayshore.
Well, in Bayshore, what happened was they were put on trial. The Citibank building in Bayshore was the court place. They might have had like a small event there, but nothing big. Bayshore is pretty resilient when it comes to these groups. You know, Bayshore actually has the distinction to be one of the few towns in Long Island outside of Westbury that threw the Klan out physically through the Holy Name Society of the Catholic Church. So Bayshore has a great history on kicking the Klan out.
About some of the other Nazi totems on Long Island. I met a guy who said he worked at a Marconi radio station. And that was sending messages back and forth to Berlin.
Yes.
See, that would be one thing. But tell us about some others.
Okay, so we did have the shortwave radio stations for the Nazi intelligence. Benson House in Wading River is one of the most known ones. If you go there today, it has nothing to do with Nazis. It's a day camp for Episcopal kids. So for our urban explorer people, do not scare the kids. They're not Nazis, I assure you. They're far from it. But once again, the Benson House, which is really interesting, there used to be a Nazi shortwave radio station to transmit all the intel they got from these aviation plants and also from Brookhaven Labs and even the ports. And, you know, they take this information they got from the ports, give it to Nazi commanders in Hamburg, and then from Hamburg, they'll give it to the Nazi U-boats to go blow up these ships coming in and out of Long Island, going into the European theater or in that New York port, which goes through along Long Island in the boat channel. That's one. But the good news about Benson House was the FBI flipped the person that had it and it became a double agent. And then it became a shortwave radio station to give false intel to the Nazis. So they were giving them bogus stuff altogether. We also got another shortwave radio station in Centerport. There's a bunch of them, but the most successful one for our intelligence end is going to be the one in the Benson House in Wading River. We also got the saboteurs that landed in Amagansett as well. Once again, George Dausch and his merry crew of crazies came from Germany and they were tasked with committing horrible, horrible acts of terrorism, blowing up the power grid, blowing up the Hellgate Bridge. They were given about $175,000 cash and they landed in a submarine, got a little boat, came to Amagansett on the shore, and they took the train from Amagansett into New York City. And the German-American boon throughout Long Island and also throughout the Midwest was to literally provide safe houses for them and intel for them so they can commit these horrible acts. But the good news is George Dausch, he turned himself in, which we're very fortunate for because that would have been horrible if they carried out any of the attacks that they had planned. He turned himself in because, once again, the story is, I don't know how true it is because he did want to probably avoid getting put to death. That's a big thing because they all got put to death, essentially. George Dausch said that, well, I went to Germany, I didn't like it, and I couldn't come back from Germany. So this was the only way for me to come back to America to sign up for this mission. And I was just going to go run off anyway. So that was pretty much George Dausch's reason for taking the mission. After the war, he was spared of the death penalty. So was another person called Ernest Berg. And when they were spared of the death penalty, they were both deported back to West Germany. And that's really good because you don't want to go to East Germany. It's not a good look for Russia and Nazis. It just doesn't sit well with each other.
Tell us more stories in your book about Nazis in Long Island.
Sure. So the U-boat raids were pretty crazy. We got the Cumbria and the Norris, which were sunk off of Quag and Montauk. Once again, these were oil tankers. They were sunk by a U-boat, I believe 123. I know, go figure, 123. And the intel that guy received was from the various networks of spies and also through maps that were provided to him. So he would literally bring the boat up, follow the boat channel based on lights of cars along Ocean Parkway. That's how he knew he was looking at the South Shore Boat Channel. And also the radio tower in Coney Island. That was another landmark for him to realize that he was at, the South Shore to blow these boats out of the water. That's why these blackouts raids were very, very important. When people say, lights out, and they put the shades down, the blackout raids, they were very important. And it was a way to prevent these, these U-boat attacks. And once again, that is just one of the examples. Another interesting fact when we talk about the Bund and how close we came to being overthrown as a country was the information wars. Hitler was spending $3 million a year to have misinformation in our newspapers. There's a guy called Lawrence Dennis, who actually became a Nazi propaganda spin doctor, essentially. I don't think he knew how big he was. You got George Viereck, another Nazi spin doctor. And what they were doing, not George Viereck, but Lawrence Dennis, they were putting articles in Reader's Digest, which was widely circulated, about how horrible the British are, how the Nazis don't want war, etc., etc., and trying to build a narrative up. In addition to that, George Sylvester Viereck specifically, he was actually writing, writing speeches for elected officials. One such elected official was Hamilton Fish. Hamilton Fish surprises me because, he's not one of the people you expect to go Nazi, essentially. I don't know how he got pulled into it. Hamilton Fish was the guy that led the colored regiments during World War I. He's the guy that talked about the Balfour Declaration, giving Jewish people a homeland. He's the guy that essentially created the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. His family was a political dynasty. And all of a sudden, in the early 30s, he goes from this Republican progressive to this Nazi. It's like, wow, that's a 180 randomly. And, once again, I don't know what factors led to it, his fear of communism. I don't know. I can't really unpack Hamilton Fish. He's a very complex person. But they're going to find out that a lot of his speeches, a lot of the propaganda, a lot of the influence through his congressional frank, which is the mailing list within his congressional district, was literally going to be used to mail Nazi propaganda. So that is going to be very, very complicated. But you're going to have elected officials like this that are going to go Nazi, and it's going to take people by surprise. Then you got the American firsters, the people that sit there and say, we're going to stay neutral. That's being funded by the Nazi regime. So how are you fighting back misinformation? How are you fighting back this propaganda? Essentially, what we did was we created alternate propaganda. We found people that reported these rumors. And we targeted populations that were susceptible with these rumors with war bond posters, radio shows, etc., etc. The guy's name, I think, is R.L. Stein. If you know, not R.L. Stein, oh man, I forgot. He was a famous detective writer. I don't know if it's R.L. Stein. I take that back. Rex Stout, that's his name. There we go, I forgot. Rex Stout was one of these most famous detective novelists. And what he's going to be tasked with is writing these wartime scenarios for radio shows, Rex Stout. And he's going to broadcast them daily. And these what-if situations that are going to keep people so attentive is going to work as a counterbalance against Nazi propaganda. Not R.L. Stein. He wrote Goosebumps. Please, I take that back. Rex Stout.
So, did the Americans create also false information to counter the false information?
Essentially, but they really guided it around rumors. It didn't come out of the clear blue. That was the whole thing. It came from somewhere. It was to counter, once again, it was tactical on how they framed it. But it wasn't as blatant lies like the Nazis. It was more exaggerated, if anything. So, yes, we're going to call this the information wars when we read the book. It's really detailed in there. And it's interesting because essentially, we go through what is a fact, and what is not a fact. When we look at facts in general, our own prejudices obscure the truth. And this is what we're going to find out during the information wars.
Do you think that has any relevance, fighting fire with fire, to what's going on today with Trumpism?
Whew. Now, that is a complicated question. Speaking of alternative facts, that is the king of alternative facts right there. Once again, I think the rise of Trumpism is a little bit different. There is alternative facts, but I think it goes back to what I said. Prejudices obscure the truth. Once again, our facts are usually colored by the personalities that narrate them. And that's where we're at right now with Trumpism. Like you got a half fact and then you make it a falsehood. Once again, I'm a moderate. I'm not endorsing any specific political party. I am a moderate. I call myself a radical moderate because moderates are pretty radical nowadays. But at the end of the day, the whole following of this quote unquote far, far right Trumpism can do no wrong or wearing hats and buying paraphernalia and stuff like that. That stuff's almost like a cult. And then when you speak to individuals that do follow that stuff and you break down the political issues with them, they'll more likely agree with centered facts, or hell, some of them might be even freaking leftists and not even know it. But Trumpism has given them kind of like a platform to have a network of essentially like a cult. I don't even know how to describe it essentially.
Well, I think it's just made up stuff, a lot of it. And my own opinion is a good way to deal with it is on the same media where you can present false stuff. The other side should do the same thing to create the illusion, now becoming a fact, that the internet is to be totally considered not factual necessarily. And you can't believe everything in it and make that by simply doing that. Anyway, that's my position. Is your book has had its premiere? Is it out now?
Yes, it's out. It's out. It's any bookstore. You should find it in any little local bookstore to your big chains, such as Barnes and Noble. And of course, it's on Amazon. Nazis of Long Island, Sedition, Espionage, and a Plot Against America. It's a good read. I like to think so. And if you really want to explore these topics a little further about the rise of crazy groups, you can even check out Ferguson Brothers Lynchin', Catalyst for Civil Rights. That's in every bookstore as well. And that book, in addition, same type of scenery, World War II, maybe just post-World War II, is kind of the area I like to write a lot about. You see a theme in a lot of my writings, the World War II era.
Thank you for being on the podcast. This has been very interesting.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it again, and thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Take care.